Okay, so yesterday we started our review of statistical mechanics. We saw that the fundamental objects are the free energy and the partition function. Where beta is the inverse temperature. And we introduce the Ising model that is the fundamental model on which we are focusing, whose Hamiltonian is the sum of some local operators on a hypercubic lattice that has this form. And this is the classical model at this point. So we have seen that there are two symmetries, in particular the Z2 symmetry or time reversal symmetry, such that the Hamiltonian for a coupling H and a certain configuration of the spins Si is equal to the Hamiltonian for the coupling minus H and the reverse configuration of the spins, which also implies that the partition function is invariant if we flip H in minus H. So this is the rest of the parameters. Okay. So we have also seen that dimensionality is very important. So we have seen that in D equal one, there are no phase transitions at finite temperature. But we have seen that at t equals zero, there is a phase transition of the first order. Whereas in d equal two, we have started to argue that there can be a phase transition, the reason being that our free energy, which is made of two terms, has two contributions that whenever we try to form a cluster of spins that have opposite orientation with respect to some reference state, they both, this cluster scale with the sides, both of these terms scale with the sides of our cluster. So that there can be in the thermodynamic limit a competition between two, this term, which gives rise to a critical temperature. So pretty much what we saw is breaking of ergodicity. We saw that if we start with our model with all spins up, and we would like to disorder the model. So disorder the model means that we start making clusters of spins down that are embedded in our sea of spins up. So now we have seen that now this configuration costs an energy that scales like a boundary of this cluster. And this is because of this term in the Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian makes me pay an energy 2j every time there are two nearby spins that have opposite sign. So this happens all along the boundary of each cluster. Okay, so this term scales with the sides of the perimeter. So this energy barrier scales with some term, let me call it small n. And the entropy of such configuration, we also saw that scales like n. So it is possible to have a competition between these two terms. So beyond this critical temperature, we have seen that the system does not like to create large clusters. So it stays trapped in a region where either all the spins are up or these clusters are very small, which means that the average magnetization is positive if we start from this one. And so this is a dynamical property. So we get an intuition that this is somehow, this property influences the equilibrium property. So we would like to prove that because of this reasoning, the equilibrium configuration at a given temperature is always with a positive magnetization or with a negative magnetization. So if this is the case, we see that the symmetry Z2 is broken because whereas the partition function is symmetric under the symmetry, our equilibrium configuration is not. The system is forced to choose one of the two configurations. So in this case, when we start from all spins up, we see that we are really forcing the system to be in the positive magnetization. Now I would like to show you that even if we flip, we have just an external forcing that is very small. So I will prove this in the case in which we only put the boundary spins of our system in plus, whereas all the rest doesn't matter. Well, this is enough to force the system to have an average positive magnetization for any given spin. Okay, so before doing that, so yesterday we saw that the density of our free energy, that is just the limit for the volume of our phase space that goes to infinity of F over V, does not need to be analytic, even though this object here is analytic for every finite V. So what can actually happen is that if we plot the magnetization as a function of the external field H, well, for a finite system, we see something like this. Okay? So this means that, well, of course, when H is negative, we have a negative magnetization. When H is positive, we have a positive magnetization. And when we send H to zero, we have zero magnetization. Nevertheless, if we increase the size of the system, this curve starts being steeper. And for the infinite system, so this becomes steeper and steeper and steeper, for the infinite system, becomes a curve like this. So let me make it bolder. Okay. So we see that if we take the limit of H going to zero from the left, so the limit H going to zero minus, we get a negative magnetization MS, whereas from the right we get plus MS. So this MS is called spontaneous magnetization. And it is called spontaneous because we are not really forcing it with an external field because we send the field to zero. Nevertheless, it depends on from what which initial condition we send it to zero. Okay, so this is what you would see if you solved exactly the model in two dimensions. And now, which we will do tomorrow, actually. But so right now, let me give you a proof of the fact that depending on the initial conditions, there will be a positive or negative magnetization. Okay, so So we are interested in the situation. Okay, so let me draw our system, and let me fix only on the boundary all the spins up. And we are interested in computing the average magnetization of one given spin. Let me call it S1. Now, let be P plus the probability of this spin having plus magnetization, and P minus of having down magnetization or negative magnetization. And then, of course, this number is just P plus minus P minus. Okay, so what can happen? So what can happen is the following. I might have a single negative spin or some positive spin. Okay, but right now I want to compute P minus. Well, because the boundary is plus, this can happen that there are some outer loops. Well, if there is a single one, there must be another cluster that contains all pluses. Then there must be some other cluster or not that contains minuses. Then, and so on and so forth. But the outermost cluster on here must be plus because of the boundary condition. Or it can happen that our cluster of negative spins contains more than one spin. So which means that our S1 must be picked in one of these. And then so on and so forth. Okay. So what is this probability? Well, this probability is given by the Boltzmann probability. So we'll have 1 over the partition function, then the energy barrier that we pay every time there is a loop around of spins with opposite orientations. So this is e to the 2j and the total length of the loop. But you see there can be configurations with many loops. So what we really have is e to the 2jl, where l is the length of the innermost loop. Well, and then we can break it in this way. L prime is the length of all the other loops that are around. So I am breaking it in this way just for convenience. So this would be the probability of some given configuration. Okay, but of course there are many ways of drawing a configuration with these loops, and also many ways of picking a spin in that. So we must count. So this is the probability of one configuration, not the probability of having one spin negative. So the probability of having one spin negative is this density of probability times some factor that depends on the configuration, then we have to sum over all the possible configurations. Okay, so I will do this approximation. So I will say that my probability of having the spin one, so let me put one here, with the negative magnetization is given by the probability of one specific innermost loop times all the rest. Okay, so this is a very crude approximation, so I cannot say that this is equal. In fact, the probability of having some configuration here is not completely independent of what can happen outermost, but at most is smaller than that. So the real probability is smaller than this one. We are overestimating this probability. So, and this one is some function of L. So we are summing over all the possible lengths times this factor here. So this is the energy, and this is somehow counting how many configurations with that shape there are and how many ways of picking the spin in that cluster there are. Okay? So again, what we are doing is that we are picking a cluster of minus spins. This has a length L. So, and what we are saying is that because there can be other outside clusters with the spin that are minus, we are just estimating this. We are just fixing the probability of the outermost spins with this factor. And now we are computing the probability of having a shape like this and picking a spin inside that. Yes?
What is L prime?
Yeah. OK, so let me. So what is the probability of having a minus spin? So you can have some cluster of minus spins, okay? And this cluster can have a length L, which can also be length zero, because you might have one single spin. Mm-hmm. Okay, but this is not the only possibility, because this cluster, well, because it's a cluster, must be surrounded by plus spins, okay? But this does not forbid that there is an outer loop with the minuses. So there are many ways of choosing this outer loop. For instance, there can be no outer loop, or there can be many different outer loops. So in order to do the correct counting, we must count all these configurations. Okay. So, and the approximation I'm saying is that this probability is given by the probability of this configuration times the others. There is no that they are independent, which is not exactly the case.
Okay.
It's not exactly the case because there are some topological constraints. For instance, they cannot branch. But I am doing an approximation, and the result of this approximation is that the real probability is smaller than this number. Okay. And now I want to compute the probability of this cluster. So the probability of one particular cluster is just given by e to the 2jl, where l is the length of this cluster, whereas all the others are e to the jl prime, where l prime is the sum of all the perimeters of all the other loops that divide the two domains. So this is to answer your question. L prime are all the other perimeters put together.
Okay.
And so actually, this has a meaning, this order probability, because imagine that we compute the probability of a given configuration without this innermost cluster. Okay? So imagine that there is no cluster inside, so these are all plus. So the probability would be just this. But then this would be the probability of having plus. So this means that this quantity here is P plus. Now, also this P plus must be a number that is at most one, right? It's a probability. So which means that if I neglect it, I make a further bound that is still valid. So this is still true. Okay? So we are producing a bound to the probability, an upper bound to the probability of having the spin number one with a negative magnetization. Okay, so now we want to evaluate this number. Okay, so let's see how it scales. And so now I will give a scaling argument. So it's an interesting exercise to try to fix correctly all the constants and see whether one obtains a good approximation for the magnetization that we can compare to the exact solution when we solve the model exactly. All right. Okay. So we know, first of all, there is how many clusters with a certain length L we can make. Well, depending on the shape, so here I'm not drawing what is the lattice, so, but imagine it is a square lattice. In order to change this shape, but fixing the perimeter, I can just change it locally, okay? So the number of changes that I can make is equal, or it's approximately equal to the coordination number of our lattice. Well, and then I can do it independently at every point. So if this coordination number is mu, and I have L independent ways of changing in mu times, this number must be mu to the L, right? So this is when I start from one specific point. Well, in reality, I can start from any point on this boundary and I would obtain always the same shape. So I am overcounting a little bit. So I have to put an L here. And actually I can proceed in this direction and in this direction to make my changes. So I'm overcounting. So again, I have to put a 2L. So a cluster by definition is closed, right?
No, the boundary of a cluster.
The boundary of a cluster is by definition closed.
If we go and at each point we choose like one of the directions and do it like L times.
Yeah.
So in general, we will not come to the same point.
Okay. Very good. So because the cluster has a boundary that is a closed loop, we must impose that we come back to the same point.
Okay, so should we like divide by some factor?
So this factor, is saying that the orientation doesn't count, but this factor here is saying that we can pick any point to be our initial and final point. So the choice of the point from which we start and end is counted here. So actually, this number does not depend on the fact that it's closed or not. This is the shape of some, it's the number of ways I can draw something of a length L.
Mm-hmm. Can you sort of give a rough estimate for how many of those configurations will be self-intersecting? Because you can't, you have to take those out of the...
Yeah, so the self-intersecting it's the approximation that I am throwing away. Okay, so this is the probability to make one shape with length L, but then I also can pick my spin in here in many different ways that scale with L square. And then I have to sum over L, and then there will be some prefactor. Okay, so this is to fix all the constants. Okay, and then we have this. So this is equal to the sum over L. Then we have A L over 2. Then we have E 2 to 2J. This is P. So, and now we have these two exponentials. So this will be 2J plus some constant C times L. So this constant C is just what is needed to make mu to the L equal to E to the CL. Okay? Very good. Okay, so now you see that the important thing is whether or not this series converges. And this series will converge when 2j plus, so also I forgot beta, you know, here. This is the Boltzmann weight. So there is a beta here. Okay. Now let me take another blackboard. So the important thing is that 2 beta j plus c is negative. Because if it is negative, then that series will converge. Otherwise, it will diverge. And we do not have any possibility of having a finite number for p minus. So we want to see what is this condition. Well, and this condition, of course, is that beta is smaller than minus c over 2j, which means that t, remember that beta is equal 1 over kt, is smaller than minus c over 2kj. Okay, so this is our critical temperature. So if we are below this critical temperature, that series converges. It will converge to some number alpha, which is an interesting exercise to evaluate. And I will give you an estimate of what type of number it is. Okay, so now what about our magnetization? This is equal to p plus minus p minus, which is 1 minus 2p minus, of course, because the sum is 1. And this is, therefore, this 1 minus 2 alpha. And this number, so this number depends on t. So for reasonable t is below this critical temperature, this number is about 0.9. But of course, depends on the temperature. Okay, so this is the proof that the expectation value for the magnetization of S1 is a positive number.
Sorry? Like, in, no, it's just when you go from one to the other,
yeah.
You know that beta is 1 over kT, so
yeah.
The second equation.
So this means that, all right, yeah, of course. Thank you. So the symmetry is broken, right? Because this S1 is different from Z. And if we started from different boundary conditions, we would find a negative number. Okay. So if S1 is greater than zero, and this is true for every spin, it means that the set of microstates on which we have to take our averages when we compute any expectation value, right? So we typically use the Boltzmann distribution. We see that it is equals, so some the expectation value of some quantity is equal to the trace of A to A minus beta H over Z. So if this average is taking over all the possible configurations, There is no way that this thing can be different from zero. But so we have just learned that we must not take all the possible configurations when we are below the critical temperature. We must only take the ones which have a positive magnetization. So this is another instance of that godicity breaking. So an interesting example is solidification, which leads me also to the concept of how exactly the phase space splits. So imagine that we have a system where the degrees of freedom are some vectors labeled by an index I. So for instance, this can be the positions of n particles, okay? For instance, in a gas. And imagine that we have translational invariance. So this means that we have some operation that sends my CI to CI plus some vector A. So this is some operation. And we want our Hamiltonian, so the energy for a certain configuration is the same if we apply our transformation. Okay, so this is translational invariance. And now we define our order parameter. So the order parameter is something that would acquire spontaneously a value that is different from zero when we are below the critical temperature, whereas it's zero order wise. So because of that, we say that the phase below zero is an ordered phase because the order parameter picks a finite value. And so we will choose for a system with translational invariance, we have a set of order parameters that depend on a vector k, and this is just this quantity. Okay. So what is the expectation value of this? Well, this is the trace. 1 over z, and then we have fik e to the minus beta h. And now imagine that h depends on some parameters lambda. Okay? Can be any thermodynamic quantity or, like in the Heisken model, the value of the couplings for our system. And we would like to imagine a situation when if lambda is greater of a certain lambda critical, then this expectation value is zero. So this would be by definition what we call disordered phase. Whereas when lambda is smaller than lambda c, this is different from zero. So the order parameter is different from zero, we call it ordered phase. Okay. Okay. So let's try to compute it. So we have to do this. Well, the details of the computation depend on the form of H lambda, but now I will only use the fact that we have a translational invariance. So what I will want to compute is the expectation value of e to the k a fi k. So I want to compute the expectation value of this quantity. You say, why? Well, let me do it and you will see what I obtain. Okay. So the expectation value of this quantity, then of course, is 1 over z, the trace of e to the ik A, then I have e to the I kc, and then I have my e to the minus beta h that depends on lambda on some configurations ci. Well, but now I want to use my translational invariance. So I can add an A here. And my H lambda will not change. So I've just used this fact here. So of course, this is nothing but K times A plus CI. And I am summing over all the possible CI. So A plus CI is just a dummy variable. I could write A plus CI. I can redefine it as C tilde I. And I still have the sum over all the possible C tilde I here. So this is nothing but this quantity. And this quantity is the expectation value of Fi k. So we're seeing that Fi k expectation value is equal to e to the I k A times Fi k. So if this is always true when you have the symmetry, this can only be true when it's zero. So this is another instance of the fact that if we have a symmetry and we sum over all the configurations, so for every configuration we sum over, we also take in account its symmetric partner, then the expectation value is bound to be zero. The only way in which this would not be zero is if our trace is taken over not all the possible configurations, but over some restricted configuration. So sigma is the set of configurations that are not related by symmetry. So this means that if I take a configuration CI, then I can take another C prime I as long as this is different from TA CI. So in this case, we can have a finite expectation value. So now we see how our phase space splits. So if this is our, this is not the lattice, this is the phase space. And this is our set of configuration sigma in which our order parameter takes a different value. Then by applying our symmetry, TA, we move to sigma prime. And only in the case the symmetry is a Z2, we go back to the original one. So it means that if I apply it again, I go to another one that is sigma 2 and so on, sigma 3 and so on. And what is the value of the order parameters in these different sets? Well, we can guess it from what we computed here. What we have is that if we restrict the sum to a certain configuration, so let me call it sigma 1, and let sigma 2, so let sigma 2 be the one that is obtained by applying my translation to the first one. So we will have this. Sigma one. Okay. So we keep going. Now there are two possibilities. Either we exhaust the whole phase space by applying our symmetry. Okay. So if this happens, this means that our model has different phases that are related by symmetry. So it's just symmetry broken. Okay? But does it have to be like this? Or is it possible that we have models in which we end up here, and there are other configurations in the phase space that are not related by symmetry by starting from one specific configuration? So if this is the case, this means that symmetry is not everything. Right? That our world is made of more than faces that are just distinct by different symmetries. So the other thing that can happen is topology. So I will give you a classical example. It has to do with polymers. So polymers are very complicated, but they have some basic aspects that are very simple. Yeah.
You exhaust phase space, or if you're limited in phase space.
So you have two possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
You are in the disordered phase. When you are in the disordered phase, the phase space does not break at all. So there are no different clusters that are related by symmetry. So this is, for instance, what happens when we are above the critical temperature. Okay? Then we can break the symmetry. So when our lambda is smaller than lambda C, or our temperature is smaller than some critical temperature TC. So we now see that our phase space breaks in some symmetry-related components. And now I can ask you the question, do the symmetry-related components exhaust all the phase space or not? So usually, yes. But there are very interesting examples, quite because it's not the usual thing that happens, where the phase space is richer than that. And so in classical statistical mechanics, one example is polymers. So polymers are complicated, right? Because these are these very complicated macromolecules. But from one point of view, they are just a noodle soup. So they have some linear geometry. And this is all that matters for our. So actually, a noodle soup doesn't really have any symmetry. It's a pretty disordered thing. So in the view of what we said, we would think that there are no two phases. Now, it can happen that for some value of the parameters or above some temperature, it is possible for these strings to pass one through the other. Then we cool down the system again, and then it's again impossible for them to go through one to the other. So what can happen is that we can have configurations like these of strings. So this is going to infinity somehow. Or configurations like this. So now the soup that is made of strings that are not knotted and the soup in which they are knotted are topologically distinct. And below a certain critical temperature, where it's not possible to for a string to go through the other one, they are separated. So these two configurations do not mix. So we see that we have a breaking of our phase space in two that has nothing to do with symmetry. So for historical reasons, this phenomenon is called replica symmetry breaking. And this is a simple classical example, but we will exploit topology a lot during these lectures to show what types of quantum order we can obtain. So what we want to do now is to move towards the quantum case. And in order to do that, I will show you. So I understand something that maybe some of you have already done, but I will review it because we will use it in order then to talk about the quantum case. So it's the transfer matrix. So, and actually, the tutorial of today is about the transfer matrix form. It contains also something about the transfer matrix formalines for D equal 2. So let's see D equal 1. OK, so what is this formalism? Well, we want to compute the partition function for a linear chain. So our model is now the D equal 1. So it's minus H minus J. And actually can write, because it's a chain, I just can write SI plus 1. Right? Instead of writing the bonds, but on a chain, the bonds are just the successive element. And we put periodic boundary conditions so that the n plus 1 spin is actually the first one. So these periodic boundary conditions make the calculation easier. That's all. They don't really affect the thermodynamic properties. OK. We want to compute this object. So this is, of course, the trace of e to the minus beta h. Okay. So what is the trace? It's the sum over all the possible configurations, right? So it's the sum over all the possible configuration of the first spin times all the possible configuration of the second, and then all the possible configuration of the n spin. And then we have the exponentiation of this object here. So this exponentiation, I can write it in this way. OK, so first of all, let me redefine for a second these coupling constants. So let me see. I will call beta h lambda and beta j capital K. Well, so what I can do is to factorize this exponential in this way. I have S1 plus S2 with lambda over 2 plus K S1 S2 times e to the lambda over 2 S2 plus S3 plus K S2 S3 times E lambda over 2 Sn plus S1. So when we wrap around the chain, plus K Sn S1. So this is just what happens, just a way to factorize this object, the exponentiation of this object. Okay, I need this over 2 here because I'm repeating S2 here and here. So to obtain the right thing. OK. So now you can see that these objects have, and we are summing over all the possible configurations of the spins. So each of these objects has four values, right? Because I can choose S2 and S3 to be +1 and -1 independently. So let me call for a generic Si, Si +1. Let me see what are these values. So of course, these are e to the lambda over 2 Si plus Si +1 plus K Si, Si +1. So we have different cases. So we have the case in which both spins are 1, right? So in this case, we would have 2 here. So we would have e to the lambda 1 here plus k. Then we can have that 1 is 1 and the other one is minus. Well, so this term wouldn't be here, and this term would be minus. And it also happens the other way around. And then they can be both minus, and then we would have e to the minus l plus k. So I can collect these four values in a matrix. And now you can see that the way these indexes are related, and then we are summing over the intermediate index, this is nothing else but matrix multiplication of all these matrices. Now, all these matrices are all the same. And then finally, we are summing also over the first spin and the last spin, so which means that we are taking the trace. It means that all this expression is nothing else but trace of T times T times T times T. So T to the N. Which may seem an impossible quantity to compute. Well, however, it's not, because what we can do is to diagonalize this matrix T. So we get some T prime. That is ST, S minus 1. So B lambda 1 and lambda 2, the eigenvalues of this matrix. And they are actually, so if you diagonalize this matrix, you'll see that lambda 1, lambda 2 is equal e to the k cosh lambda plus minus square root of sin h square lambda plus e to the minus 4k. Okay. All right. Well, so if we do this, then the trace of this matrix of T prime to the n is nothing else but lambda 1 to the n plus lambda 2 to the n. Now, by inspection, you can see that lambda 1 is greater than lambda 2. But actually, for every one-dimensional situation, this would always be the case, and I will prove it to you in a second. And right now, let me just use it. Well, then I can write this like lambda 1 that multiplies 1 plus lambda 2 over lambda 1 to the n. So in the case of large n, well, this is a number smaller than 1. So this is just lambda 1 to the n. So because of that, this is that. Okay, but now we want to write our density of free energy. So this is the limit for n going to infinity of f over n. So it's this limit of minus kt over n log of z. So log of this. But then this is just n log lambda 1. So the n's here go away. So I have the log of this quantity here with the plus. So this is our free energy. We can compute everything from it. So this is the usefulness of the transfer matrix method. Let me also show you this thing. First of all, I have to tell you about this. So why this is always the case, the lambda 1 is always greater than lambda 2, and also that is always positive. So it is because of the Perron-Frobenius theorem. It is a very useful theorem and says if we have a matrix Tij where all the entries are positive, so this is the case here, right? They're all positive. Then the spectrum has this property. First of all, there is the largest eigenvalue is greater than zero, is unique. So there is no degeneracy. It is very important. We used it, otherwise we couldn't write this thing. And also lambda one is analytic in these entries. So lambda one is analytic in these functions. So the only way that we can have a phase transition is when the entries themselves are not analytic. And so this can only, we have already seen that this only happens when T, the temperature, goes to zero. But here, the only way to have something that is non-analytic is if this K goes to infinity. Well, but K going to infinity means beta going to infinity means the temperature is going to zero. So if you work out the calculation for K infinity, what you find is that, well, pretty much this term doesn't count, right? This one goes to zero. And then we have the square root of the square of this function, which means that we just get the absolute value. And the result is that lambda 1 is equal to just e to the k, that is the what is here. So this is for large k. E to the k plus lambda. Absolute value. So this means that our free energy, because then we have to take the log of this, is minus n kt capital K plus absolute value of lambda. And what is our magnetization? Is 1 minus n, the partial derivative of f with respect to h, but h is nothing else than lambda apart from the beta. So which means that this partial derivative is actually equal to plus 1 when h is greater than 0 because of the absolute value, and minus 1 when h is smaller than 0. So we see that we have the phase transition t equals 0 that we announced the last time. So one very last thing is the following. So the tutorial, among the other things, will ask what happens in 2D? Can we generalize to higher dimensions? Now let me also show a little passage that will help us when we talk about the quantum case. So here we have this matrix. That is our matrix T. So if we introduce the Pauli matrices, so sigma x is 0, 1, 1, 0, sigma z is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. We see this, that this can be written like the exponential of the sum of two Pauli matrices. So we see that this is like the exponential of k times sigma x that gives me these two entries. Plus, I have these two entries here. And this is k. So actually, I have k here. And here I have lambda sigma z. So there is a way to write our transfer matrix like the exponential of some operators that so are like quantum operators. So tomorrow we will see that thanks to this trick, the statistical mechanics of this chain, well, can be seen as the exponential of some parameter for this that seems like the Hamiltonian of a single spin. Sorry, I didn't understand. Well, what is
it? Don't you need sigma x plus lambda sigma z plus 1 for the unit matrix? Or I don't know. Maybe
no, I think it's.
I think that when you exponentiate matrix.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Never mind.
No, this is the expression. So I just want to mention that this looks like the quantum Hamiltonian for one spin.
Yeah.
And this K looks like the imaginary time, but this looks like the evolution imaginary time of a single quantum spin. So somehow the evolution imaginary time of a zero-dimensional quantum system enters the statistical mechanics of the classical model in 1D. So in one dimension more. So tomorrow we will work out this mapping. We'll see that this is a typical case that the time evolution of a quantum model in D dimensions. So, but now we have to say D plus one because we have time, because there is time evolution, is equal to the statistical mechanics of the classical model in D plus one spatial dimensions. And this is something that we'll be using a lot. Questions?
Can you repeat the conditions of the Perron theorem?
So just that we have a finite matrix. Okay, so what I forgot to say is that we have an n times n matrix where n is finite, so it's a matrix. And all the entries are positive numbers. So one of the things that the theorem says, because it also says stuff about the eigenstates, which right now I don't remember, but is that the eigenvalues have the property that they are analytic in these entries. and that the greatest eigenvalue is unique and it is greater than zero. So there is no degeneracy. So by the way, the Perron theorem shows that at every, because lambda 1 is analytic in these entries, and at every positive t, so unless I make this limit, these entries are also analytic, then there cannot be, in a one-dimensional model, there cannot be a phase transition at finite temperature because of the Perron theorem. Okay.